Support for WPR comes from 4imprint, providers of promotional products for businesses, including embroidered apparel, trade show items, and logoed business gifts. More is at 4imprint.com. 4imprint, for certain.
Support for WPR comes from Amplify Health. The doctors, clinics, and hospitals of Gunderson Health System and Bellin Health have come together to form Amplify Health. AmplifyHealth.org. A little empathy changes everything.
Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and today we start the show by taking a look at consumer protection issues, and we'll talk about the top 10 consumer complaints from the past year. Larry Mueller here with Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke. Michelle's the administrator of DATCP's Division of Trade and Consumer Protection. Michelle, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having us, Larry. It's a big day.
it's a big day indeed. Michael Domke is the director of DATCP's Bureau of Consumer Protection. Michael, good to have you back as well.
Thanks, Larry. Happy to be here.
And, of course, as you listen to our two experts, I hope you'll join in. Want to hear from you. Have you received any odd phone calls lately? How are you making sure you're staying safe on the Internet? Give us a call. The number, 800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Michelle, how's the DATCP top 10 consumer complaint list compiled? Is it purely numbers, other factors?
It's purely numbers. Based on what consumers file written complaints with our agency about. So we receive a number of different phone calls and contacts and questions. Those don't factor into this. This is all about what people actually file that written complaint about. And our staff works to help mediate those issues, investigate them, possibly have further enforcement with different companies in regards to those. And then as part of that mediation, staff employees are coding. We have particular identification codes, and then we just tally the numbers at the end of the year.
So how does this year's list, Michael, compare to the previous year's list? I mean, are there surprises? I imagine there's some movement up and down once in a while.
For the most part, most of the categories have remained the same, but there was a little bit of movement, and there was also some, I would say, noticeable increases and decreases in some of those categories regarding the number of complaints that we received.
You know what? I was going to start from the top down, but let's go the other way. Let's start from the bottom up, and Michelle, what was number 10?
Well, number 10 is motor vehicle accessories. You're going to hear us say the words motor vehicle a couple of times on this list, but this is about those accessories and parts. So individuals who maybe purchased a part online because they're a do-it-yourselfer, or maybe they're a classic car collector or whatever that may be, trying to save a buck here or there on simple things like windshield wiper replacement versus I need a new engine. And so it's anything on that spectrum. We saw issues related to refunds, a failure to deliver products, and misleading representations, primarily with online sales for those parts. And so we want to make sure consumers are paying attention to what it is they're being promoted, and those advertisements, those guarantees, warranties, return policies, that all factors into this category, and keep that documentation.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Well, so there we have motor vehicle accessories. Michael, what was number nine?
Number nine was travel, and that really is a robust category that includes all different aspects of traveling, such as your airlines, flight tickets, booking those, hotels, lodging, including those vacation rentals and those platforms that we see with the online. Also in auto rentals, And then traveling bundles. So those services that we see where the, you know, you rent a hotel and then they give you a discount on a car rental. And a lot of the issues we see there are really the billing disputes where you think you're paying one thing and you get charged something else and trying to actually get what you signed up to pay for. The refunds and the adjustments based on some of those policies. So if you suddenly unexpectedly have to cancel, understanding what those responsibilities are for you and what you have to pay and what the company's obligation is to return that money to you. And then those charges above what the estimate was. And those kind of include some of those fees that you might not think about. We see sometimes at vacation destinations, those resort fees or those additional things that you didn't quite notice when you were making that reservation.
Yeah. And there were 244 complaints in that area, as I think I remember. And there were, for the motor vehicle accessories, I think there were 141. So, all right, in the large scheme of things, it seems like a small number, but if you're one of the 240 or whatever it was.
Yeah, you're going to see these numbers drastically change as we go up the list. And I suppose we should give the overall number, 11,374 total written complaints. So 141 of 11,000, that's a significant percentage of complaints.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, what about number eight, Michelle?
Motor vehicle sales. This is both new and used. We'll say we work closely with the Department of Transportation, especially in the area of dealers, because of their authority in that category. But then we have 297 complaints, and where we step in is a lot on some promotional advertising to entice the consumer to come in, like prize notice mailers. So people may see those in their mailbox and say, oh, yeah, no, I'll go take a test drive in order to win $10,000 or get the package of Girl Scout cookies, you know, because there we see the range of prizes that are available. And we have direct regulations over those types of mailers. And so consumers are aware of this. They pay attention. They let us know if they feel something is misleading based on what's written and what happens when they show up to make that purchase. And that's where we see a majority of those complaints come in.
So motor vehicle sales, and then there's motor vehicle repair is another one, isn't it? Isn't that number seven, Michael?
It is, and as Michelle mentioned, you're going to see it three times, and this rounds out those three motor vehicle categories. Last year, we had 341 complaints, which is about 11 less than in 2023, so relatively the same volume. And the most common issue we see here is work quality. So, you know, you go in, you pay for that repair, and then maybe it's experiencing the same issue, or it only runs the way it's supposed to for a couple of days, and then all of a sudden there's another problem. Another is really damage or the loss of the vehicle. So while you have it in for one thing, all of a sudden something else gets broken and damaged. And we can help out with some of those, and we mediate through trying to get an understanding of what was expected and what the problem was and what can we help show that, yeah, that was repaired or it wasn't. And then the other is delays, or kind of representing how long it should take and to get that vehicle fixed, and whether there's a communication between the shop and the consumer on how they can know, hey, this is what really will get back to you in the driveway so you can have it, and when it won't. And a good example of that, when we had a complaint where a consumer had their vehicle in, the vehicle was damaged while it was in the shop for something else. And due to our involvement, we were able to get that consumer $1,000 back from their towing fees and their $3,000 repair bill wiped clean. So we got the damage taken care of and they got their money back.
You know, we should just mention, I mean, there are a lot of people listening will know this process because you both have been on for many times. But what happens if under motor vehicle repair or any of them, what should people do regarding a relationship with you?
Yeah. We really encourage consumers to call us in advance of any transaction. Do that research, check things out. And so that's where you can reach out to the Consumer Protection Hotline, get information on the subject area that you're looking to involve yourself in a purchase. Then if you have trouble file that complaint with Consumer Protection. And once we receive that written complaint, we will reach out to the business, share the complaint with them, and we try and mediate, find that resolution. At the same time, we're evaluating the information against the regulations under state law to see if the business is being compliant. And if not, we work on that side of the issue as well, not just trying to resolve the issue for the consumer, but making sure businesses are educated on the regulations and that they are also complying with them. And so file that complaint in writing. You can go directly to our website to do that at datcp.wi.gov. Or again, that hotline is 1-800-422-7128. Now, I don't want to misrepresent that we can resolve every issue either, because sure, we're not the courts, and so we can't make a business engage with us. That would be if there's enough compliance issues, an investigation, and further actions that would be taken. But through that mediation process, many businesses do engage and try and resolve things. It may or may not be what the consumer is seeking, but we do get a lot of businesses to help offer to resolve issues.
So we've had, we've gone through motor vehicle repair. So the next on the list, number six, is Michelle what?
Medical services, 439 complaints in this category, most of them really being about billing disputes and that medical services that you've received. Unsatisfactory service and misrepresentations fall in here as well. We work with the Office of Commissioner of Insurance quite a bit because you can have coverage from your insurance, and should it cover, shouldn't it? That's going to be for them to analyze those policies and issues. But then those things that you are responsible for paying for, were they properly disclosed? Is there no surprises? Are they charging more? Was the service actually provided? That's where we're going to be in this process for the medical services aspect.
So it's a pretty good number of people complaining in that area. And number five, Michael.
Number five. And this was where we're going to see our first movement. Number five was telecommunications. And
I bet that number goes up there.
That one was number four last year, and now it's number five.
Dropped.
Not expected for us as well. We were surprised by that. We received 527 complaints last year, which is down 115 from the year before. So pretty good drop.
That's a 20% drop.
In this category, telecommunications really includes your internet, phone service, those types of things. But it's really important to differentiate what our authority is there. And what we're helping out with is billing disputes, your satisfaction with the carrier, the terms that you signed up for under the contract. Are they adhering to those? Was there any misrepresentations made when you signed up? Perhaps there was a discount, or they promised you a certain type of speed or connection. And then what we can help out with those is trying to understand what did the contract entail. And that's why when we speak with consumers and we have these opportunities, we really encourage them to understand their contract, understand what is expected, pay attention to what some limitations are, maybe based on their geographic area. They're not going to have the same service they might expect, or they may get in a metro area. And then also keep those copies of the contracts and everything that you get when you sign up, because that'll help us should it get to a situation that we need to intervene and help mediate. Then we understand what the expectation was when you originally had that contract. And then, of course, give that carrier an opportunity to fix the problem. Give them a chance to look into it, understand if maybe there is a technical issue that they can fix before we need to intervene and help out. But the one thing I want to emphasize at the end is we can't help with those quality issues. So if you just have an issue and say, you know, my internet's slow or my phone keeps dropping, the only thing that we can help with is if they had a representation that, you know, we guarantee no calls will ever drop, or we guarantee a certain internet speed service, and it kind of shows they're not fulfilling that, we can help there. But for the most part, quality and coverage, that's not us.
Michael Domke and Michelle Reinen from the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection, our guests today. We're going over their top 10 list of consumer complaints for 2024. And of course, answering your consumer issue as well. And I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News as we talk consumer protection issues with our two guests from the Wisconsin Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection, Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke. Great to have both of them with us today. Question or comment, maybe an experience to share, I hope you'll join in the consumer protection area. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. So we're moving up the list. We've got number four, I think, is next.
That's right. Number four is identity theft. 618 complaints. This moved from the number five slot to the fourth, and more than 150 additional complaints over last year, or the previous year, 2023. Here we saw an emphasis on online account takeovers. Many of the complaints involve the compromise with Facebook accounts. And it's so important that consumers understand that online account takeovers is a form of identity theft. And it's something to pay attention to because of the implications it can have. Social media profiles being taken over by scammers can really lead to serious issues and long-term consequences because they can use that compromised account to access the owner's personal finances, personally identifiable information, and they can take control of an internet-based business if you have one or whatever else you're doing online. And they can spread the scam that they are facilitating to friends and family members. So it can multiply and roll out of control here. So if you suspect any suspicious activity on your online account, you need to respond to that. Talk to the platform, change your password if you still have access. If you've lost access, you need to communicate with the platform and let them know that. This really emphasizes why it's so important to have different passwords for different platforms and online accesses, because if that scammer gets one, now they have it for all. Yeah. And again, this is a complicated issue to get yourself out of from the scammer, the identity thief, and how it can just impact your life. So be monitoring your identity.
I just actually last night talking to a friend whose husband started getting emails from friends, and they were apparently somebody had gotten his email list or his Facebook list, I think it probably was. And they were sending out something that is supposedly coming from him that he needed money for. I don't remember all the details, but he needed some money for something. And so his friends were emailing him and saying, hey, what's going on here? You're having some surgery and you know, all this and that. And so now that's a compromise, obviously. What would a person do in a situation like that?
Well, there's a couple things that could be a compromise where they have access to that list and they're doing that and they need to get a hold of their account again. And usually you have to work with the platform in order to regain access, change passwords, but you need to be notifying your contact list as well.
Yeah.
So they don't respond to this issue, because now when they respond thinking they're talking to you, they're talking to that scammer. But there's also those situations where it's masked. It's the spoofing where they don't really have a hold of your account and control it. It looks like it's from you, but when you hover over it, you can see that it's really coming from somewhere else. We talk about that a lot in phishing attacks and things. So you need to see if you're no longer receiving contact like you normally would. Your profile is changing. You can't get yourself logged in anymore. But it explains why it's so important to not stay logged into things. Log yourself out so you log back in and keep those passwords up to date and changing them.
John wonders, how do you know if someone's using your social security number? That shouldn't be.
Well, there's a few things you can look for. I mean, the social security number itself, and depending on what it would be used for, there are some indicators for identity theft, and we have resources on our website that will encourage everyone to take a look at, where there's indicators that can show, you know, maybe your identity was compromised. And some of those might include suddenly receiving more credit card applications in the mail and you haven't applied for. Maybe suddenly your mail has stopped. You might also, different agencies that we interact with, could be all of a sudden your tax return. You go to file your taxes and you discover that it already had been filed and you realize that didn't happen. Also with the Department of Transportation, you realize maybe you get a new driver's license in the mail or suddenly you stop getting mail at all. Like, all these are different types of flags and indicators of how your identity might be compromised. How your social security itself, that card may have been, that's a little more difficult because there's so many different areas in which you can, you know, potentially use that to create a fictitious identity or try and obtain loans. So in addition to those little things, also making sure that you're checking your credit report and taking a peek at that. And that can be done for free. The federal government provides the ability to look at that once a week. So at annualcreditreport.gov, I would encourage everyone to take a look at that. And that will show you also if there have been any types of activity or someone trying to use it. And that was also a way for you to say, okay, maybe there's something larger going on and you need to take some steps to protect yourself.
Ned in Sparta, I think relates to this, emailed us, what are the implications of the recent release of personal information records from the Treasury Department? Hard to know.
Yeah, it's difficult to know what that's going to look like, and the agency's working on that as well as others are. And at this point, it's access to information for read-only and review.
Well, let's move on because we're getting nearer the top here, and we're at number three, which, Michael, is what?
Number three is home improvement, and that stayed at number three, but we did see a drop of 203 complaints for a total of 664, which is about a 25% decrease. So while we did see a drop there, it's still at our number three spot. And seeing the issues there are kind of consistent with last year, and that is work quality. So you're having a home improvement project, and you didn't quite like how it went, or it's not what you expected. But then also delays in that project. You know, you said when you sign that contract, you have an expected timeline when the work will be complete and not getting it done on time, or sometimes not even completing the project at all, or providing any of the materials for that work. And then also is the lien waivers, which are protection afforded here in Wisconsin and contractors not providing those. And here we have another success story to show, kind of illustrate when we get involved, what can happen. And that was a construction company who had taken work down, about $128,000 in payments for a project at the homeowner's residence. And they took that money and never performed any work at all, and instead spent that money on their own personal expenses. And so as a result of us getting involved and looking at that and partnering with the district attorney's office, that particular contractor was convicted of that crime and ordered to pay that money in restitution. And so, you know, that's an example of what can happen if we get involved. But there are things you can do on the front end as a homeowner and a consumer before you get into these projects to put yourself in a position to be protected should things go sideways. And that is making sure you get all those expectations and deadlines in a written contract. Sometimes we might have a relationship with a friend or we know someone who had done work and they say, hey, can you just toss the roof on? Yep, it'll cost about this. But we know sometimes relationships sour, or maybe there's a different price. So making sure you get all that in writing, and then always getting lien waivers. This is something we try to make sure we emphasize when we have opportunities on the importance that lien waivers are and how you're protected. Because if you don't have those in place and that contractor didn't pay the supplier for those materials for your particular project and things, you know, go off, that supplier could put a lien on your home. And that means you end up paying twice. You pay the contract and you pay the supplier, and you don't want to do that. So again, I encourage everyone to do a little bit of research. Our website provides a great checklist of what you can do if you're going to explore a project and stay protected in the front end.
And you know, yeah, I'm wondering how many thousands and thousands of home improvement projects of one sort or another, got to be tens of thousands almost, you'd think, in the course of a year in the state of Wisconsin, or any place else for that matter.
It'd be a lot.
So in some ways, it's good to see only 600 or whatever it was. So, excuse me, let's turn to number two.
Well, some might be surprised, and at the same time, it's no surprise. Telemarketing complaints, 1,513 complaints. And the surprise might be that that's not a larger number. We've seen in the past it be 3,000 and 4,000. It had creeped up over the 20 years that Do Not Call was in place and really reached that peak at over 4,000 complaints, and has been decreasing the last 2 to 3 years here in its number. And some of that has to do with the technology that's really in place now, and consumers have tools that they can use to combat those phishing and spoofing scams, imposter scams, robocalls, the harassing calls that come, and even the state Do Not Call registry to combat legitimate telemarketers who are calling to sell you something. That is a tool that's available and enforced in our state. But the other things are anti-spam technology that's built into the latest smart devices, our cell phones. The work that the telecommunications providers are doing to authenticate calls and label them when they come in. So we see that label of unknown caller or spam. You don't answer it. You let it pass, or it even blocks it altogether. So we want to be sure consumers are alert that there's still plenty of calls coming in. They are labeled. Use those tools. But let us know. Still file those complaints so we can get the word out on this program and others about what types of things are circulating, like the law enforcement imposters and jury duty notice scams and lottery scams that are circulating and toll booth things that we've talked about over the different months that we've been here.
Yeah, Don in Columbus had called, couldn't stay with us. He's wondering if you folks keep a list of all the scammers who violate the Do Not Call list.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, we have the complaints that come in, and so we conduct searches to try and identify those callers, work with our federal partners, and then when we can identify them, we make sure that they are part of these complaint categories, and then we see who is violating the law, who's a scammer, and then we proceed after those that are legitimate telemarketers that aren't following the law, and make sure we share the data on the scammers with the our national and other state partners.
And it's, I suppose, in this day with an age with voice, the ability of a scammer to like replicate somebody's voice and that sort of thing, I imagine it can be difficult to tell sometimes. How do you tell? How can you tell if you're getting a scam call?
I don't know that you can ever convincingly tell, or that we have the secret magic wand to tell you this is how you can definitively tell if it's a scam or not. It's really about understanding what those red flags are and what you should look for so that you can keep yourself protected. You mentioned a good one about how these new growing technologies are making it more difficult. And we're not just seeing it in these scam calls. We're seeing it across a bunch of platforms where technology is making it more difficult. But replicating voices is one of them, where historically, they would have to pretend to be somebody else. But now with just a little bit of audio, and we know that a lot of us have social media platforms and profiles, and we record things or we post things, and our audio is out there, and scammers can use that. And so before, they would have to come up with a little bit more of an elaborate story and try and convince you as to why someone else was calling, or maybe they didn't quite sound like that family member you thought would be calling. Now that voice is more convincing, making it difficult. So it's taking a pause. It's if you a red flag goes off, listen to your gut. You know, take a minute to think about what is happening in front of you. Don't react quickly. Try and vet what you're hearing. And oftentimes that just involves hanging up. just hanging up and then calling back to everything that person might be that you believe was calling for help or needed assistance, or calling someone else to talk through what that situation was that you're being presented with, whether it's, you know, these imposter scams from the government or utility, and saying, this is what happened. Does this sound right to you? And usually when you talk through someone else who is not on that call with you or emotionally invested in what's happening at that time, you're going to start to see, yep, the red flags of the scam become pretty bright.
Alice had emailed us in sort of relation to this. How can you tell if someone calling you about jury duty is a scammer?
Well, it's understanding the process of how you get notification of jury duty, and that comes by mail. And you then get the information as to how you have to call in to see if you're selected and when you report. But they don't call you to say you're up for jury duty or that you miss jury duty. It's a different process. And so you can always reach out to validate that process with those officials. You can call your local municipality and ask questions. You can call the local courts in your county to find out, how do I know if I'm selected for jury duty? Most of their websites will also have information that you can validate against. And that's what we try and do. Do your research and verification or validation before you engage with someone who calls you out of the blue.
Matt in Ashland emailed us. Matt's heard that Michigan sued insurance companies for increasing rates to Michigan residents due to payments from hurricanes and fires that aren't major losses incurred in the northern states. Apparently, the state won, and it decreased rates for Michigan residents. Matt has seen rates for home and auto double in 2 years. Is this an option for Wisconsin? And maybe a little out of your category, Michael.
It would. That question is a good one, but it was better suited for Office of the Commissioner of Insurance to answer. They're the agency that licenses and regulates insurance companies here in Wisconsin, and I'm pretty sure they'd be able to explain what those rules and regulations and how that may impact policyholders here in Wisconsin for him.
Well, we've got, I'm sure we're going to hear some more relating to telemarketers as the show goes along here. But we might as well cover, before we go to George and Westport, we might as well cover the number one issue, Michael.
Drum roll, please. Number one is landlord-tenant. This was also number one last year, and we also saw an increase here of 317 complaints for a total of 2,525. So by a margin, our number one category. And again, probably the most common issue we see here involves security deposit returns, and that is making sure that both sides understand what the responsibilities are for really kind of understanding the amount that needs to be returned, and then those withholding statements. Sometimes they're unclear, or money gets sent back without an explanation or understanding as to why not all of the money from the deposit was returned, and in some situations not returning it at all or within that timeline. It's important to emphasize here in Wisconsin that you have 21 days, a landlord has 21 days to return that security deposit back to that tenant unless there's any type of withholdings, and then provide a detailed statement to do so. But other things we see include evictions or unauthorized entry, so you're just suddenly showing up and coming into the property, and then infestations or mold damage, or it's really just maintaining the property and that relationship between the tenant and the landlord or the property owner, and sometimes even that management company. And we always want to emphasize that how important that relationship is, because where you live is very important. It affects your day-to-day life and how things are going. And so if you try to make that extra effort to have that good relationship, it goes a long ways. If you have additional help, we have some resources on our website. Our landlord-tenant guide is a great, robust explanation and understanding of what both sides, both the landlord and the tenant, what their rights and responsibilities are to help create that harmonious relationship. And then we also want to really kind of highlight a success story for us that has helped out a lot of tenants here in Wisconsin, and that is with a recent settlement with a business called Parada Properties Management. And through those complaint mediation and our investigations and looking into those business practices, we determined that there were a few things that needed to be tidied up. And that resulted in, you know, a $1.7 million settlement. And within that settlement, there's $850,000 that'll be returned to tenants, in addition to some other obligations and programs that will help tenants. But it also will help that property owner and landlord understand, you know, how to do business the right way and make sure moving forward, everyone is in a much more position to be successful.
Yeah, makes that's good news. It's always good news. George in Westport, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, George.
Hi there, Larry. Thank you very much for this program. I really appreciate the focus of this. It seems that since January 20th, at least on the national level, consumer protection is taking a back seat to a lot of things. But more locally, I am very curious to know the true details behind a report that a local CBS network is reporting regarding a grocery chain. I think it's the Metro Market or Pick and Save. What are the details of that? I know that this particular state agency is involved in that. Thank you.
Michelle, are you familiar with that?
Yeah. I think what he's talking about is a press release that we issued at the end of November of 2024 related to some work that the Bureau of Weights and Measures conducted, which is in this division of trade and consumer protection. And through a statewide survey conducted by state inspectors, weights and measures inspectors, and local city sealers, they did inspection over the course of a number of days with the Roundy's Corporation stores in our state, and they were able to identify some package checking violations that had occurred, and so product wasn't weighing out appropriately on the packages prepared by the company. And so we went into a settlement agreement with them, and they've put in place a number of different compliance steps in order to reach compliance for consumers so they will get what they pay for.
Sounds like another win. George, thank you very much for calling. You can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. Do you have a consumer concern or maybe an experience to share? I hope you'll join in. I'm Larry Mueller with my guests Michelle Reinen and Michael Domke from the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection here for WPR News. Taking a look at consumer scam issues here in the state of Wisconsin with our two guests from the Department of Ag, Trade, and Consumer Protection's Division of Trade and Consumer Protection. Michael Domke is director. Michelle Reinen is the administrator of the division. So it's great to have both of them with us. Questions, comments, and experience to share, give a call at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Let's take a call from Joseph in Wausau next. Joseph, hi, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I'm driving, so hopefully you can hear me. I just recently, last week, was having problems with my printer, my HP printer, and my laptop connecting. And I looked up and Googled HP support, and found an 800 number and dialed that, and they basically, it sounded like it was an overseas type number, but not unusual, but they said they were HP support, and they basically said, you know, yes, let's take a look at your drivers and things like that, and they wanted my email address. So I gave them my email address, and they literally were in my computer. So they were driving the computer as I was driving the computer, looking at the drivers and kind of doing some work inside of it, and then they basically said, yeah, you've got some corrupt files here, the drivers are corrupt, et cetera, et cetera. And there's three different options you can go with to correct your problem, and they were very expensive solutions. You know, the cheapest one was $600, $800, $900, whatever. And I said, you know, no thank you, I'm not interested, I just wanted to see if it was something, should I reload the file or whatever. And they said, no. And I said, are you sure? Are you HP support? And they said, yes, we are. Here's our number, blah, blah, blah. And I said, okay, thank you. I'm not interested. And they abruptly hung up, and I hung up. And I thought, oh, my gosh, they just came into my computer. Since then, I have not had any problems with my computer. I log into it every morning, and I'm not seeing anything changing in files or anything like that. Should I be very concerned right now that they, that being, I think it was HP, I hope it was HP, was in my computer?
Michael?
Yeah, Joseph, I think there is a little bit of cause for concern, and I would, if you have the opportunity, take your device into a computer expert and have them just do a quick security scan to make sure there wasn't anything left on your computer that will continue to give the individual who previously had access the ability to get into whatever they want. We understand that there are some solutions where when you're getting tech support, you're going to be asked to give that remote access. We really, if at all possible, discourage anyone from providing that access to an unknown source, even if you initiated that contact. It's really a little bit safer to take that device in and have an expert at that shop provide you with the assistance where you can see what's going on, what can happen. Because with that remote access, you never really know when that's going to be shut off. And in addition, when they're in there, they have access to everything. And so you don't know what they're really looking at or what they may be downloading or what they, if they're potentially putting some malware in there to kind of screen off things. So there's a lot of risks that come with that type of support. What we can do moving forward is I would just make sure that you continue to watch those things, look at what is happening with your personal information. We talked earlier about those tips for identity theft. Take a look at our website for some of those red flags and make sure that your information doesn't get used down the road.
There you go, Joseph. Thanks. And I have to tell you, Joseph, about 20 years ago, this I did the same thing. And I was immediately, kicking myself and went straight to the Division of Information Technology on campus. And they just sort of took cleaned my computer off, and we started all over again. And I felt a lot more. I felt a lot better when I did that. In fact, I did it like about an hour after, within an hour after it happened, I happened to be able to get down to that service. So I know how it can happen. It hasn't happened since, I can tell you that for sure. I just wouldn't allow it, but there you go. Fife, I think from Northwoods email, does your department do anything with MLM people? They're called multi-level marketing, and they don't seem totally legal. He got some firming cream from there, and it didn't work at all. Plus, the salesman was really pushy on Facebook.
Why, yes, we do deal with multi-level marketing. We regulate the actual employment opportunity behind that, if you will, and the disclosures that are required in relation to, is there truly a product and the investment into the company in order to move up and in that balance and in between product purchasing that the employee, if you will, has to do in relation to the earnings that they can have. And so it gets pretty complex. You know, is there truly a platform or will the bottom fall out on this? But we also get involved in if there's a product and it has claims and it's supposed to do particular things and it isn't, that's just product sales. So this could be an opportunity where I might want to file a complaint with us so we can take a look at what they're seeing.
Gary in Appleton, we'll go to you next. Hi, Gary.
Hey, Larry. Regarding the gentleman that had the HP question, I belong to the HP Monthly Inc. Subscription service, and I've had problems in the past, and I've called the 800 number for HP and, overseas call with tech support, and they've gone into my computer. And they've done a wonderful job. So probably 2-3 times over the past 2 years, I've engaged with them. And nothing happens whatsoever but fixing the solution. So no reason for concern for the gentleman that called earlier.
But that would be, thanks, Gary, but that would be assuming that he was like Gary, a part of this HP special service.
I agree. If you have 100% certainty that you're talking to HP and you determine based on the issue that you're having that you're willing to take that risk, that's certainly every consumer's option. Our goal is to just provide the education on what risks come with those decisions and what may happen if things go sideways or while somebody's in there. You know, we were talking earlier about how do you really tell if, you know, a call is real or if somebody who says that they really are. And now there's so many opportunities for scammers to, you know, list fake websites, you know, when you do that particular Google search to come up, or to be able to mask particular websites to look like the real thing, whether it be HP. If you're confident that you are talking HP and that's the only solution, certainly your choice to make. Just understand the risks that come with it.
Paul in Madison, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Paul.
Hi there. So I've received the advice, or I've heard other people talking about, like, reporting to DebtCap when it comes to landlords who are violating code, either just one time or frequently. And I'm just curious, like, what kind of enforcement actions you guys can have in those situations?
Well, it's entirely going to depend on the issue that you're having with the landlord. So we will evaluate that complaint against the regulations that we're responsible for enforcing. So security deposit return, notification of entry to the property for maintenance or showing, disclosures at the time of a rental agreement, prohibited practices, things that they're not allowed to do. And then we will contact the landlord and go into our mediation process to try and reach that resolution. We can't mandate or order the landlord to engage with us or provide a refund or resolution to the situation. However, if we determine that there are violations of the administrative rule, the law, we're going to look at that on the enforcement track. That might separate from your individual complaint. And we may initiate an investigation and work with our regulatory partners at either a district attorney's office or Department of Justice for additional enforcement. But that's a progressive thing. You know, it could be as simple as a letter that tells them that they're non-compliant. A tenant may be able to use that if they take and decide to go to small claims court to seek a financial resolution if one isn't made during the mediation process. And maybe it's a voluntary assurance of compliance, a written document that outlines what they're going to do to come into compliance. And to that full settlement with that case Michael was talking about where there's an investigation and a referral and it goes to court and it's an entire process.
Involved.
Yeah. So it's a range of things that can happen based on a single complaint or 100 complaints.
Yeah. Paul, thank you. To go along with that, Steve emailed, is there a naughty nice list for landlords or do you have one?
We do not have a naughty nice list of landlords, but with any business, a consumer can certainly call us and ask us if we have complaints against any business, and we will share that we do or that we don't. We will not share the context of those complaints because we want to make sure we're giving an impartial feedback to that particular caller, but it's certainly something a consumer could take into consideration. For instance, in the landlord-tenant area, if you're looking or trying to decide between two or three properties and you call us and you find out that one property has one complaint and another one has 100 complaints, that may influence your decision on where you want to go. And also keep in mind, though, we always want to provide that disclosure is just because a particular business has a bunch of complaints doesn't mean it's a bad business. It just might mean that there were some relationships that went south, or sometimes consumers might just have unrealistic expectations about what they were supposed to get or wanted. And so, but it still is a factor that you might want to take in consideration.
Kyle emailed, do you work with at all with the Better Business Bureau so consumers know what businesses have received the most complaints?
We work with the Better Business Bureau in that they're one of our consumer protection partners, but we're very different in our entities. We're under state statutes responsible for enforcing state laws, and the Better Business Bureau is a nonprofit that has member businesses, and they have their standards for performance, if you will, to be a member business. So they receive complaints and try and mediate them. They share their data with us when we are doing an investigation, but we don't have a free exchange back and forth on a regular basis of complaint information.
Michelle Reinen is the administrator of the DATCP's Division of Trade and Consumer Protection, and Michael Domke is the director of the Bureau of Consumer Protection with DATCP, our guests. Questions for them? They're going to be with us right up till 12:30 today. I hope you'll join in. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at consumer issues, consumer scam issues with our two guests today, Michelle Reinen, administrator of DATCP's Division of Trade and Consumer Protection, Michael Domke with us as well, director of DATCP's Bureau of Consumer Protections. At 12:30, we'll talk about care of your septic system and avoiding stinky issues, I guess we could say. But first, you have a consumer issues, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Kathy in Oshkosh has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
What's on your mind today?
Well, I got two situations, and they're both extremely similar, and both reflect on Facebook Marketplace. One was I was selling a washer dryer, and the other I was selling a truck. And my truck was worth quite a bit. And so I had it listed for what I wanted, which was at the time $33,000. And this guy contacts me, says, "Well, is there any problems with it?" I go, "No, not at all." And so he goes, "Well, how much are you asking for it?" So I knew he wasn't looking at the ad. He just saw the title. So I said, $50,000. And he goes, "Okay, I'll send you a check for $75,000, and you pay the guy who's going to come pick it up for me the difference."
Oh.
And right away, I knew it was a scam. But then I said, "All right." So he sent the check via Federal Express, and I gave him a different name and a different address. And when it showed up at that address, they're wondering, "What the heck is this?" And I looked at it, sure enough, I took the check to the bank. I said, "How can you prove to me that this is a fraud?" And they go, "Well, this is a real bank, but there's no account for that." They got that far. And so I said, "Okay, thank you." I tried contacting my local police. I said, "Nothing we can do until you're a victim." And then I said, "Well, okay." So then I found out there's a FBI website called ic3.gov, and that's where you're supposed to report scams. So I said, "All right, I'll do that," and kind of left it at that. But now I got a real interesting piece of wallpaper to put up.
Well, that's a typical scam, isn't it?
Yeah, she described it really well. Thank you, Kathy, for doing that, in that it's a classic check overpayment scam that involves a fake check. And you have a product for sale. Someone's enticed by it. They offer to pay you more, ask that you give the difference to someone else or send it somewhere for some reason as it relates to the pickup. And then you go to cash the check and you're out the good you were selling and out your cash because you've handed over the excess to someone else. Maybe you've even spent some of the money you've earned and your checks are bouncing because that was a fake check. It's no good. And IC3.gov is a resource. We also take those complaints at Consumer Protection and report them as well. So that was a great description. It's hard to see these scams on marketplaces. But you need to watch for those red flags, and being offered to pay more for something is certainly a giant red flag.
Yeah. Kathy, thank you. Let's go to Barbara in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Barbara.
Hello. I was scammed about a year ago in March. I have a Roku streaming bar for my television reception, and it stopped working. And when I went on the website, they directed me towards an RKU Solutions company. And I called them, and they said, oh, well, your subscription to Roku has expired, and so you have to redo that subscription. And I said, oh, really? And how much is that? And they talked me through a few options, yearly. And anyway, I said, oh, that sounds expensive. And they said, well, we could let you have 3 streaming premium channels for free for life, and you can renew your Roku subscriptions for life. And I asked them what was the cost, and they said $329.99. And I said, oh, that sounds fine. So I made the deal, and I sent them the check, and I never really got those. I mean, I got them because I had already subscribed to those premium channels. My Roku started working, but now I'm finding out that it was a scam, and I'm not getting those premium channels anymore. Have you ever heard of anything like that?
Michael? Well,
Barbara described a couple of variables that we see in typical in other scams. We're reaching out and attempting to engage in maybe an additional subscription or really maybe solicit some of the information. But one thing for Barbara is I would encourage you to file a complaint with us and give us an opportunity to try and mediate that. It's possible that maybe it wasn't a scam and that she did renew her subscription, but maybe there was some type of either glitch or missed opportunity for them to have added those services or what they were supposed to do. So we would want to look at what the agreement was, if her service is continuing to work when it hadn't. I'm not quite sure if it necessarily was a scam or if maybe there was the company didn't fulfill on their end what they were attempting to sell.
And so for Barbara, she's gone, give a call maybe or go online, I suppose.
I would encourage, have Barbara give us a call on our hotline at 1-800-422-7128, and we'll be happy to help her out with how she can file a complaint and guide her through that process.
Okay, 1-800-422-7128, the number to call, Barbara. And thank you very much for calling. Andrea and Krakow, your turn. Hi, Andrea.
Hi. So I would say that this might not be a scam, but I feel it's exceptionally unethical. My elderly father, who has dementia, is getting bombarded by Medicare insurance providers calling him to get him to switch. But they're not even really telling him that he has switched. He also has cancer. I take him to all of his doctor appointments, and he has providers like that I do not want to switch by him switching constantly Medicare. I called directly to Medicare. I'm listed as, his caretaker because my mother has passed away. But they said there's nothing they can do about it. They have the right to call. They said I could call the Federal Trade Commission. What is the law? And, why can they call? He basically hit the maximum times to switch now, so I got him back to his plan that he was originally on. But this is crazy. He was getting, because I blocked all the calls, he was getting up to 10 calls a day. They sold his number. This was horrible.
Mm. There's a couple things that could be happening here, Andrea. The first is if some of these businesses, these Medicare providers, are legitimate businesses attempting to try and get your father to switch over, they would need to register as a telemarketer to make sure that they're operating ethically and also that they're not calling numbers on the do not call list. So if your dad's phone number isn't on that do not call list, I encourage you to do that right away. You can find information to do that on our website at datcp.wy.gov. But in addition, you're also going to want to understand that sometimes what Medicare had said in regards to stopping everyone from calling, some of them may not be legitimate, some of them might be unscrupulous, and it's just going to be a matter of trying to filter through and screen those calls. Paying attention to the current provider, whether it be those billing statements and understanding what those services are being provided, is very important. So I'm happy to hear that you're doing that. But there's the kind of a range on whether or not those providers can be calling to solicit those services. And if they are registered and that number is not on that list, if it doesn't border on that harassment side of it, unfortunately, it's just one of those angles of people trying to solicit business.
Yeah. So get him on that do not call list if he's doesn't sound like he may not be on it.
If he's not, I've certainly encouraged him to get on that list. And if he is on that list already and he's continuing to receive those phone calls, certainly file a complaint with us, and then we can follow up and look into that. There are some exceptions to the do not call list, but that's for us to kind of look into and determine whether or not a violation has occurred. But I absolutely would encourage if he's on there to give us a chance to look into that.
All right. Andrea, good luck and thank you so much. Hey, and thanks for taking care of your dad, too. Appreciate that. John in Kokana, your turn. Hi, John.
Hi. I don't think I'm calling. I don't think I'm being scammed, but I'm kind of at an impasse with having had a new furnace installed. And I think it's too big of a furnace. That's why it's noisy in my ductwork. He's suggesting it's the ductwork. And the only way to quiet it down was to eliminate the high stage of heat and just the low stage of heat, and it quieted it down somewhat. But now I feel like I functionally have a one-stage furnace, which would have been $2,000 less than the two-stage furnace. So I'm not sure what to do, and he's come a number of times, and he thinks everything's fine the way it is, and I haven't paid him yet. And a second concern that I found out after reading the warranty when it was installed. He had installed, which he said was an upgrade, and it might be, to put stainless steel burners in it instead of the galvanized, which I think might violate the warranty that only warranties parts originally provided in the furnace.
All right, Michelle?
Well, this is one of those kinds of complaints that we receive where there might be an impasse in the work that John's been doing already with his contractor on this issue, and filing a complaint may help open up those lines of communications, and so certainly can do that. We don't regulate the selection, but if there was a representation that this was the correct furnace for this size house in this situation and it's not, that could be where we step in. But if this is correct and that's what was represented, we don't have a path or a role in that. So it's really going to be important to provide all the details of the transaction and the contract in filing that complaint, and then we'll be reaching out to the business on that.
And to do that, again?
Yeah, you can call the hotline at 1-800-422-7128 or go directly to the website at datcp.wi.gov.
All right, John, there you go. Thanks for joining in. You can call us, too, and get you on pretty quickly at 800-642-1234. Tax day is coming, April 15th. What do we need to know about preventing tax-related ID theft?
Well, I guess the most important thing is to make sure that you're trying to file early and understand the little additional protections that are available to you so that you can make sure that when you file, it's actually you filing. And One of those protections is really the IRS and the Wisconsin Department of Revenue both offer identity protection PINs. And what those are is kind of like that secondary authentication that verifies you're the one that is filing that. And so it limits someone who might have some of your personal information and is attempting to file a tax return with that to obtain your refund earlier. If they don't have that PIN, they won't be able to file. And so both the federal and the state agencies offer that, and we encourage everyone to use that resource and tool. As I mentioned, filing early, the quicker that you can get that submitted, better the opportunity is that you'll be the one who receives the return and no one else can do so afterwards. Also, when you're filing, making sure that you're not storing all that sensitive data on a device. You know, once we know that some of these programs and tax programs will store it in the cloud and store it on those, but if you're saving a copy of that, maybe on your laptop or maybe if you're doing it on a tablet or a phone, try and delete those as soon as you're done with that. Don't keep those documents on there. And then, of course, get rid of that recycle bin and empty that too, because a lot of that data is very important. So if it were to be the device were to be compromised, they'd have access to that, and that can lead down a dark path. Also, when you're doing that, you know, protecting what you're doing with those actual documents that you print out. If you don't need them and you don't need to hang on to those because they're being stored in a cloud or somewhere else, shred them. Using a crisscut shredder, and it seems kind of archaic for us to be talking about how should we be shredding, but when we were talking earlier about technologies, they're getting so much better, and even those strip shredders, there's technology now that can just take even a portion of those and put a full document together just by looking at it. So that's why we want to make sure we're using that crisscut. And then last is placing a security freeze on your credit. On your credit reports. And that is so important because if your information is compromised, it prevents that thief from opening a new line of credit or accessing those things without you validating that you want to do it. This can be done very, very easily. It's done with all three credit reporting bureaus and is probably the best protection you can possibly have for free.
Mark in Janesville will give you a chance. Hi, Mark.
Yes. So my mother has been dealing with a scam for the last couple of years on catfishing. She's going through the app, WhatsApp, I believe it is, I don't know. They're getting her to send money in different ways. So she won't give me any information. She's telling me that she's taking care of it, and I've, the rest of the family knows it's still going on, but I, you know. So is there anything I can do to help this out? I've offered her advice and help any way I can, but she's, telling me no. So I'm.
That's difficult, isn't it, Michelle?
It's really hard. And this might be where you want to enlist the help of others that she may trust and be able to listen to in addition to yourself, because she may feel monitored in some ways. And so we have a Wisconsin Consumer Guide that talks about romance scams, and we also have fact sheets. So providing that layout in education can be one thing, so she can see it on paper. Talking with the bank may help her realize that this is what's really happening and what can happen if she continues to send money. Some banks aren't able to continue to support a customer who sends money to an individual in a romance scam. It might be useful to enlist the assistance of like an ADRC because they have other resources. AARP has resources to help with victims and talk about this as well. So she can see, one, she's not alone, and two, they can help identify all the red flags and warning signs, and that she is a victim. She's not made a mistake here, and we don't want to blame her for anything that's been happening because that will just shut it down further.
Mark, good luck with this issue. I hope you can get it resolved. John and Mason, we'll go to you. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. I just wonder, is there a do not email list, like the do not call list, that you can sign up for?
I don't believe that there is, John. There is a list, as you know, for the Do Not Call, and there is a opt-out pre-screen that you can sign up for to stop getting that regular mail, paper mail that you get, but I'm not aware of any list that would stop or prohibit people from emailing.
There you go, John. Thank you. You mentioned Valentine's Day, and we've hit romance scams. I'm wondering about AI. Is that changing the way romance scams appear?
It really is. You know, we were talking earlier in the program about how voices can be changed and how that technology is kind of being used across the board in a variety of scams. And certainly romance scams are going to be one of the highest areas that it is. And a couple ways that it's changed the game. First is the images. You know, historically, we had always advised users or consumers that if you're on a dating platform and you're seeing a picture, one way you can kind of edit whether it's real is to do a reverse image search, which means you'd copy it, you throw it in a search engine, and you see if it pops up. And if it's popping up, you know, on the cover of Vanity Fair and the cover of Motor Trend, and you realize, all right, this probably isn't the real person that I'm talking to. The challenge with AI is AI can create unique individual photos that don't appear anywhere else because they're one-offs. And so when you do that reverse search, you're not going to find anything, adding more legitimacy to that profile. Another thing AI is being used in the romance scams is it's able to aggregate data very quickly, meaning if I look at your profile, Larry, and I say, how would I best engage? I can quickly use AI to build a perfect profile to match you. And so then you're going to look and say, wow, look at all these common interests that we have. They seem to be the perfect match for me. And that kind of breaks down barriers and those red flags that someone might see. And then also AI is being used to really kind of fast forward the process. It's being able to mimic those voices so we don't have to have a one person doing everything. It can automate all of that and get that engagement and that interaction moving much, much quicker.
Oh, boy. Well, fortunately, that's not anything I've had to deal with personally. I'm glad to say. Do you have an update? Here's another email. Do you have an update on PIN and chip scams on debit and credit cards? How secure is the new tap feature on cards?
Well, I think that the tap feature itself can be very secure, and there's different kind of layers of what you think will be the most secure way to use the credit card. When you're using the chip and you're putting it in, one risk that comes with that is the skimmers and skimming devices. We see both can be on, you know, gas stations, the most common that we talk about, but also at that point of purchase and grocery stores will overlay on that big square kiosk that's sitting there. We've seen them installed there. So that's one risk. The tap to pay when you're actually using it at the device, I would say, is pretty secure. Now, there are some, we have seen some areas where the scammers are putting Bluetooth devices attached nearby and they're trying to grab it, but that's very complex and difficult and you'd have to really hide it. The most secure way to ever pay for something is to walk inside and hand cash to someone, but that's also a little archaic. Tap is pretty secure.
Marcus emailed, wants to know if there needs to be a minimum amount of money involved with a consumer complaint before a complaint can be filed with DATCP, Michelle.
That is such a great question, Marcus. No, there does not, because sometimes there isn't money involved in a situation. Maybe you just want to make phone calls stop from a company that is harassing you, or you want to get off a particular list situation. So no, there does not have to be a minimum amount of money involved. We just encourage consumers to provide as much documentation and information that they have about the original transaction, anything that's transpired since then, and any interactions they've had in order to try and resolve it themselves.
And maybe one more quick one here. You've noticed scammers who are impersonating law enforcement recently, Michael.
Yeah, we have. And we've seen it before, and sometimes we see spikes and ebbs and flows, and we recently have seen a spike that is not isolated to a particular agency. It's really across the board. and they're impersonating law enforcement in a couple of ways. Historically, we've seen how they've called and said you have a citation that is overdue or a warrant for your arrest, and if you don't pay immediately, we're going to be coming around and doing this roundup. And then they'll ask you to pay in these obscure methods like gift cards or cryptocurrency and a lot of flags. But the most current one that we're seeing is really the jury scams. They're jury duty, where they're impersonating law enforcement and saying you missed jury duty, and if you don't pay the penalty for contempt of court, there's a warrant and we're coming to arrest you, and so on and so forth. And so in all of those, we want to make sure that you're understanding, just because the caller ID says the local law enforcement agency, don't trust that. Just because they identify themselves with a badge number as a particular officer, don't necessarily need to trust that. If you're concerned, hang up, call the local law enforcement directly. They're not going to be mad at you because they know these scams are out there and they'll validate it.
On that note, we are out of time. Michael, Michelle, thank you both so much for being with us, and we'll look forward to your next visit. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Larry.
Michelle Reinen is the administrator of DATCP's Division of Trade and Consumer Protection. Michael Domke is the director of DATCP's Bureau of Consumer Protection. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Oh, Tommy Brandt is the artist for the Septic Tank song. I didn't know there was such a thing, and I'm not sure if our guest did either. Matthew Jansen's our guest. And we're taking a deep dive literally into the topic that's often overlooked. But I tell you what, it's essential for many homeowners, and that is the septic tank system or septic system. Larry Mueller here. Matthew Jansen is with us. Matt's the private on-site wastewater treatment systems plan reviewer with the Wisconsin Department of Safety and Professional Services. As we talk with Matt, I hope you'll join in. When was the last time you inspected your system? What do you avoid pouring down the drain or flushing down your toilet? Maybe you're wondering how to tell if your septic system is failing. Give us a call. Number's 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us to talk@wpr.org. Matt, you're the private on-site wastewater treatment systems plan reviewer, and that's a mouthful.
It is a mouthful, yes.
tell us more about what you do with your job.
Typically, we call it POUTS, which is an acronym for that. Otherwise, we just use septic systems. Most people understand what we're saying when we say septic system. So what my job is I'm actually a field person, so I interact between the homeowner, pumpers, plumbers, county agents for us. I joke around that I should have a black and white shirt on and a yellow flag. I play a referee between everybody, make sure the state rules are enforced and everybody's on a level playing field.
So. Oh, my gosh. Well, who's actually responsible for maintaining septic system?
Well, the maintenance themselves is the responsibility of the homeowner or business owner. So they're the ones that are ultimately responsible to make sure that it's being maintained. And that's... there is a requirement, a state statute and administrative code that requires at least once every 3 years that the systems are or the tanks are looked at to see if they do need to be pumped.
Okay.
So many of your listeners are probably aware of or familiar with a card or a letter that the county sends them to say that they're due for their maintenance.
And so it's every 3 years?
Every 3 years, correct.
Okay. What if you've never pumped your tank?
Well, they should still be getting a maintenance card. Legislation had taken place several years ago where they required all the counties to do an inventory of all the systems that they have in their jurisdiction, and then as part of that, put them on a maintenance plan. So if they haven't, then they're sort of fallen off the radar of the county or the local governmental unit. But I'd say 99.9% of the folks out there are getting – some kind of card and asking for maintenance.
Yeah. Craig in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Craig.
Hey, I have some neighbors that had their septic, their field probably, or the pipe going to the field freeze. And so he called the local plumber, and they said, yeah, they've gotten about 60 calls over the last few days about septic lines and fields freezing. Anything you can do to help that?
Well, there are a few things that you can do to help prevent freeze-ups. Unfortunately, once you have a freeze-up, the best remedy for that is spring. Because you know, the conditions there, I mean, we can do some things to help it along, but it's like putting a Band-Aid. And until you fix the root cause, and that could be either adding better insulation to your tank, which isn't a common thing that's done. Also, your drain field, if it's freezing up. Keeping the grass a little bit longer out there, letting snow cover help insulate it. This year we haven't been blessed with a lot of snow cover. That's the reason we're seeing freeze-ups.
Yeah, so not a whole lot you can do.
Not a whole lot. I mean, you can hire people that can jet it out. You know, they'll take like steam and they'll jet out your pipes. The problem is if it's still cold outside and you still don't have snow or insulation, you're going to have freeze-ups again.
It's going to freeze up again. Oh, Craig, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. And it's important to maintain that system. I got to believe. You're not going to be happy when it's not working.
No, it's one of those things that it sort of harkens back to, you know, the late night commercials. You know, you instead of set it and forget it, you flush it and forget it. Most people aren't thinking about what goes on. You know, as long as the plumbing works in the house, you don't think until you have a problem. And most of the things are things that you can do in your home. I mean, not putting things down that are a detriment to the system. So even though things say like they're flushable, most likely if it's not toilet paper or something that came out of you, it probably shouldn't be going down the drain. It's going to cause problems either in the septic tank for the pumper, or it may bypass and get into the drain field and cause issues down there.
My sister has a septic system and lives out in the country. And one thing she always, I take her grocery shopping from time to time. And one thing I notice, she always looks for toilet paper. There's toilet paper there's a kind that is better than, there are types that have a little code on them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do see some of that, you know, the manufacturers, propose that their product is better than others. There's a wide range of products that are useful out there and you know, ones that are, you know, not much causes a detriment, but some can be better than others. And I guess I could just recommend to the readers, you know, to do your own research on the internet. But for the most part, the toilet paper brands, you know, they're not usually the root cause of the problems. It's other things that are non-biodegradable, you know, flushable wipes, you know, cigarette butts, other, as I call them, human artifacts, other things that people put down the drain that shouldn't be down there, or things like greases and oils or paint thinner, stuff like that. You know, it upsets the biology of the septic system and can harm your drain field.
Adam in St. Croix Falls has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Adam.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I recently bought my house about 3 years ago, and shortly after I noticed there's a small sinkhole. It appears to be right over top of the line in the drain field. Wondering if that's an indicator of a problem.
Sort of a sinkhole.
Yeah, if you have a sinkhole or if you have some kind of change on top of your drain field, you know, it may be a problem. It may not. And so that's something where you're really going to have to call a professional, have them come out there and evaluate it. It could be something as simple as, you know, gopher or woodchuck, you know, burrowing into your system. It could be something more severe like a pipe is broken and you have a disconnection there and it's actually eroding out part of your, you know, part of the soil from the wastewater as it's being discharged out to your drain field. So it could be something more severe or it could be something as simple as, you know, a rodent or somebody, you know, something digging out in your drain field.
You could have somebody come and take a look at it then?
Yeah, you would hire basically the plumbers. The way Wisconsin's set up is that in order to work on septic systems, you have to be licensed as a plumber. So if you call one of your plumbing shops and ask, they're divided whether people work in interior or exterior plumbing. As long as they're either a full master plumber or master plumber restricted, they can work on septic systems.
Okay. And this isn't probably the best time to be doing it unless you have a problem.
Again, it's really tough to evaluate things when everything's frozen up. If it's something obvious like that, like you have a hole and you have sewage coming out of the ground, obviously that's something that they can note. But otherwise, especially if there's something possibly wrong with the drain field and a soil evaluation is needed, that you're going to have to wait until spring when weather conditions improve.
Adam, there you go. Thank you for calling. Ann in Watertown, we'll go to you. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I have a question about do we need the need for adding bugs or bacteria to your septic system?
Well, that's a great topic. I call it traditional folklore, is that basically anything that comes out of your body that goes down the drain, the septic system and the drain field are designed to treat that wastewater. We don't really need to add anything. There's a lot of commercial products that purport to do certain things, but the simple fact is the biology on its own will take care of that waste. So I've heard a lot of folklore remedies such as, flushing down yeast to a dead mouse or a dead chicken in a septic tank to a cup of dog food. It's really unnecessary. The waste itself has the bacteria in it. The soil has bacteria in it. It will take care of any waste that we do put down the drain into that tank and that drain field.
All right. And there you go. Thank you for calling. Karen in Madison, your turn. Hi, Karen. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for fielding my phone call. I'm an urban dweller, and so I know nothing about septic systems, but it does make me think about, okay, when there's a break in a pipe, and what about protection of waterways, and, the sewage that goes down through the soil, and are there rules where people can actually build so that, we're not willy-nilly putting septic systems? And how costly is it for the land? Because now with so much growth in, like, Dane County and the city of Madison, and, is all of that factored in when you allow people to put a home in the middle of the country somewhere?
Yeah, Wisconsin first implemented rules concerning domestic sewage or private sewage in 1914. So Wisconsin's actually been a forerunner across the nation dealing with septic systems. So there's a whole host of different codes that require separation distances, both vertically and horizontally, from things that may impact wastewater. So when we design systems, not only does it go through a tank for some settling and basic digestion of the waste, but then it goes out to a drain field, whether it's a conventional or a mound or an at-grade, and then that's the sort of the final purifier clarification of that wastewater before it goes into groundwater. Potentially. So we have separation distances that we have to maintain. There's soil tests that are done to evaluate the soil to make sure we meet those separation distances. So I know there's a lot of concern about development, but each individual home is individually sited, very precise when we look at things. They are being addressed individually. As each home builds, we look at each individual site and determine what they can do or can't do on that site.
Yeah. Karen, there you go. Thank you. Ann in Toma, it's your turn. Hi, Ann.
Good afternoon, and thank you so very much for this program. It's just timely. My septic pumper told me to put root killer down into the septic system, via the toilet. And I said, well, how often should I do that? He says, whenever I think about it. Well, I think about it every day.
So you got roots growing in your...
The seed has been planted, so now you're going to think about it.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, something like that. I mean, if we do have root intrusion or something, it's sort of akin to talking about freeze ups, is that, by putting something down the drain, and there are products out there that will make the roots sort of retreat or shrivel up or exit that area. But the problem is then it's sort of like putting a Band-Aid on an open wound, is that you need another Band-Aid, another Band-Aid, another Band-Aid. And really, the issue is why do we have roots intruding in there? And is there something that we can do to stop that? And that goes into there's a whole nother discussion. I mean, if trees are already existing in longstanding home and you're having root intrusion, that's one thing. But we also get some others where people, have a mound system newly installed and they want to plant shrubs or trees. and, you know, things like that. You have to be careful what you plant around it to make sure that we're not causing detriment down the road. So in cases like that, you can have an additive that will help remove the roots, but really it's sort of a Band-Aid on a long-term situation.
What should you plant on a mound? I mean,
grass.
Grass.
That's about it. You can get by with some other things. I know people have done some flower beds, other shallow plants. But really, the more things you plant out there other than grass, you start to run a higher and higher risk. So if you want shrubs or you want trees, that's a higher risk. Certain types of trees that are water loving, like maples, for instance, or willows, they will seek out that water in your drain field, and next thing you know, you'll have root intrusions. So the farther away you can keep them, and I know sometimes we put systems out there and people are worried about losing a tree, and we say, yeah, even if the tree lives, the problem is it's going to be close to that drain field, and you're going to have root intrusion problems down the road.
Ann, thank you so much for calling. Matt Jansen, our guest today, private on-site wastewater treatment systems plan reviewer with our Wisconsin Department of Safety and Professional Services, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at septic systems today with our guest, Matt Jansen, who is with the Wisconsin Department of Safety and Professional Services and zeroes in on these kinds of issues. Great to have him with us today. And Joe in Jefferson has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Joe.
Hey, Larry. You guys are a great resource. Love WPR.
Thank you.
Yes. Kind of a two-part question. First, just a quick follow-up on the weed killer. I was told to put that down the vent, not in the toilet. Does it matter? Like, out in the, I have the, not a mound, but I have a drain field. So I don't know if it makes a difference, but they probably both have a vent pipe that you'd put it right there, because wouldn't that be where the roots would be? Not something that needs to go down the toilet and into the septic box, correct?
Correct. I mean, again, if you do have roots, you need to sort of look at where the roots are getting in and why, and possibly address that. There may be a crack in a pipe or something where the roots are getting in. If they're just infiltrating your whole drain field, that's a whole nother issue. It's usually because plants or trees are too close. And again, putting any kind of root killer down there is just putting a Band-Aid on the bigger issue.
Yeah. There you go, Joe. Thank you. Susan in Fitchburg, your turn. Hi, Susan.
Hi. So I have a septic system, and I'm wondering, is it a good idea to buy those little pouches at Menards where you put one down your toilet every month, and it's supposed to, I guess, replenish the bacteria in the septic system? Is that something good, or is it not necessary?
As we had mentioned before with another caller, is that, you know, all the bacteria that are naturally occurring in the waste and in your septic tank is more than sufficient to do the breakdown of the waste. And, you know, the products that are additives aren't really necessary. A lot of manufacturers purport to do miraculous things, but really the waste that's there has bacteria in it. It will naturally decompose on its own. You don't need to add anything to it.
Yeah. Susan, there you go. Mark in Appleton, we'll go to you next. Hi, Mark.
Hi there. I was wondering, I go up north ice fishing, and I end up with some minnows and some little shiners left over, and I don't want to put them outside because my dog gets into them, whatever, and I'm too far from the lake to throw them to the eagles, and I can't find anybody to use them. Is it okay that I have a basement toilet that goes right out to the field? Is it okay to pour little shiners and minnows down?
I doubt that would cause any harm to your tank. Most of the septic tanks on like an average three-bedroom home are 1,000 gallons. So a few minnows going down there, you know, it's organic material. So it would be no different than if you had a fish fry and you had extra piece of fish or something that happened to go down the drain. I mean, you obviously want to minimize the amount of organic matter that you're putting down drains, but I don't think that would cause a problem. Just like anything, minimize the impacts that you have. Dilution is the solution kind of thing.
Mark, there you go. Let's go to Joe in Lac des Flambeaux next. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I'm wondering about laundry drain into a septic system and or garbage disposal. At one point, I heard that, you know, that's not good, the laundry, because so much coming in at one time stirs everything up. And so I'm just wondering about what's the opinion nowadays. Thanks.
Well, by law, all discharges from a home have to go into a septic system. So laundry does have to discharge into a septic system. So they can't be daylighted out on the ground. There's actually quite a few contaminants, bacteria, things like that, that are in the laundry water, and they have to be treated. So that's your first answer. But sort of tying in with the garbage disposal and laundry, again, as I mentioned, sort of dilution is the solution. If you're doing laundry, you'd like to try to spread it out during the week instead of doing like 7 loads on Saturday. If you do 1 load a day, it's easier on your system. It helps keep the contents, still, and it doesn't stir things up. If you put a lot of water in there, it's going to stir things up. Also, with the garbage disposal, if you're on a septic system, you want to limit your use. Anything that would go down to garbage disposal can also go down your garbage can, and it's most likely or best that you put it down the garbage can instead of running it down to garbage disposal. Just makes your system work that much harder.
Fred in Owen, Wisconsin, we'll go to you. Hi, Fred.
Hi, I just had a question about the potential of building a new home, but the issue of being able to perk or not perk when it came to the system was brought up with the land, and I was just kind of curious if you could explain that a little bit.
Sure. You know, a lot of the vernacular is people still say, does a site perk or not perk? Percolation tests have long since been written out of the code. So we don't do a percolation test anymore. That was pretty much pour water in a hole, see how fast it goes away. If you're on something like crevice bedrock, water will still go away fast, but it doesn't get any treatment. So we actually do a soil analysis where we'll have people that'll go look at the soil profile and determine loading rates based on the structure, texture of the soil to determine how much it can handle and if we have a separation distance to groundwater or perched water tables or bedrock if we would encounter that. So what most people are thinking of, does it perk or not, is that does it come back as something other than a holding tank? We do give at the state, you know, the county's actors are agents, but individual counties can pass ordinances while they will more may restrict holding tanks to a system of last resort. So if they do that and your system only is suitable for a holding tank, then you would not be able to build on that site because they would say no new construction for holding tanks. So that's what people usually refer to when they say, does it perk or not? Whether that holding tank is restricted, that's up to a local county ordinance. Otherwise, if it does, quote, pass, then you would get either a conventional or a mound or an at-grade or some other kind of system other than a holding tank.
Fred, thanks for calling. Bob in Stevens Point, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I have a conventional system. The kids have moved out, so it's just mom and I on a four-bedroom system. And every 3 years you get the card to have it inspected. And the question is, should I have it pumped or should I just have it inspected? And I've had two different pumpers and they tell me different things.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the state requirement is that every 3 years that you have the system evaluated, and it has to be pumped out if it's more than one-third full of scum and sludge, so more than one-third full of solids in the tank. If it does not have one-third, it can be signed off by various different credentialed people, and then you can postpone it for the next period. But if it is more than that, then it does have to be pumped. So pumping it more often probably isn't going to hurt anything. Yeah, we do remove bacteria, but there's plenty still in there. And by the time the tank fills up, it will be working just fine. So it's sort of like, you know, getting your oil changed on your car. People recommend every 3,000 miles you change your oil. If you go 5,000 because some synthetic products or other high mileage, you can go longer. That's up to you. But you're not going to hurt anything by pumping it out, but you can have it inspected if you so wish.
Bob, there you go. Thank you. Jack in Madison, your turn. Hi, Jack.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. We had some friends that had the wooden top of an old septic tank suddenly let go, and the half of their front yard settled out about 3 feet. They got that taken care of. But my question is about my property. Two things. One is there's an old well somewhere on the property, and I'm curious about your ideas on trying to locate that. And the other is supposedly there's a septic tank out back by the barn that was popped out when lightning hit the barn sometime in the 40s. So I guess that kind of brackets the time frame that septic system would have been constructed in. I'm wondering about your ideas too on trying to locate that tank before my riding lawnmower drops into the pit.
Yeah, old unused tanks are problematic because usually it's before sanitary records were being kept. A lot of counties have started keeping sanitary permit records sometimes in the late 60s, early 70s. And even those were spotty. So before that, you're talking 40s, you're probably, your guess as good as mine, what might be out there or where it is. You know, trying to find something like that, if you still have piping connected to it, there are some companies that do have cameras that they can send down to try and track the pipe and find out where that tank is. Without that, the only other way is basically a long steel rod, and you walk out and you probe to see if you can hit a lid or hit a cover. But if you have a lot of rocks, you're going to find them before you're ever going to find a tank.
Oh, yeah, there you go, Jack. And Karen in Holman. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question as far as alarm to warn us if our septic's going to back up. We didn't have an alarm when we moved in, and we had a little backup, nothing major, but we then eventually had an alarm installed. An electrician put the alarm in, but he didn't know about hooking it up like out to the tank. And then when we had the tank pumped, the next time I asked him about it, and he is like, well, it looks like it, but I don't know about the electrical part of it. So.
Oh.
Yeah, there's some tanks. If you just have a holding tank, there's no drain field, so they have an alarm in them when they're ready to be pumped. Otherwise, traditionally, we'll see an alarm on a tank where you have a pump involved, where you're pumping it out to a drain field. And that alarm is out there to notify you basically that the pump did not kick on. So if the pump did not engage, now your tank's filling up with no place for it to go, the alarm will kick on for that. So that's the two typical ones that we see with alarms. If there's something else that's out there, I'm not familiar with what he would be putting an alarm on.
Matt, we're going to have you back. Still callers online with questions. Appreciate you being with us very much.
Sure, absolutely. It's been fun.
Matt Jansen with the Wisconsin Department of Safety and Professional Services, our guest. Great to have him with us. Tomorrow on Garden Talk, Brian Huddleston and Lisa Johnson will be answering your questions. We'll be live from PBS's Garden and Green Living Expo. In the meantime, thank you for listening and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller.